Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for words and their stories and people in America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington.
And I'm Anna Mateo. On our program today, we talk about food and drink playing a part in cultural identities. Later in the program, we hear about how potato fries are part of Belgium's cultural identity.
But first, are you a coffee drinker or a tea drinker? Asia has a long tradition of tea drinking. China is no exception. However, lately, more and more Chinese are turning to a different drink.
In big cities such as Beijing, coffee shops seem to be on nearly every major street corner. These shops are not just selling drinks from the coffee company Starbucks. Coffee businesses from South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Britain are also operating in China.
Anna spoke with some Chinese women to learn if they like coffee or tea since moving to the United States.
Tea drinking is steeped in the culture and traditions of many Asian countries, like China and Japan. But is that changing? Are young people from Asia now choosing a cup of coffee instead of tea? Many young Chinese people drink coffee socially when meeting with friends. Yang Lin lives in the U.S. but comes from an area in China famous for growing tea. She used to only drink tea while in China, but now she says she drinks both and for different reasons.
I was definitely a tea drinker when I was back in China, but now, you know, with all the Starbucks influence, all the different flavors, the holiday drinks, I think I like coffee and tea equally now.
Yang Lin says that drinking coffee for her is a social event. She and her coworkers like to sit in a cafe and talk over a cup of coffee. Tea, she says, is more about family memories. She grew up in Fujian province, an area known for its tea. Ms. Young says that as a child, her family would gather together in the evening and talk about the day's events over a steaming pot of tea. So now, even the smell of Fujian tea brings back these warm family memories. Vo Yo is another Chinese woman who now lives in Washington, D.C. She says that after moving to the U.S., her tastes changed. We would call her a coffee convert, someone who now chooses to drink coffee.
I used to be a tea drinker before I came to the United States, but now I am a coffee drinker and actually getting to become a very heavy coffee drinker. Like, I grow from one cup a day to three cups a day, and if I stop one day, I will have headache.
On average, a person in China drinks about 5 cups of coffee a year. This information comes from the China Coffee Association, Beijing. That amount is far below the world average of 240 cups a year. But the association says the amount of coffee that Chinese drink is growing by about 15% every year. On any given day, Groove Cafe, a South Korean coffee chain, is busy with activity and coffee drinkers in Beijing. A chain is a group of stores or businesses that are usually under the same ownership. With more people drinking coffee, many see an economic opportunity. China-grown coffee could be a moneymaker, even if most of the coffee on sale in China is imported. Most of China's coffee is grown in the southern province of Yunnan. a French missionary, brought plants to the area over a century ago. But the roots of growing coffee did not take hold until more recently. I'm Ana Mateo.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. We just heard about the changing tea culture in China. Now we hear about a kind of food linked to a culture, fried potatoes.
Some people want the United Nations Cultural Agency to place Belgian potato fries on its cultural heritage list. Christopher Cruz brings us that story.
The Reuters News Service reports that potatoes reached Belgium in the 16th century. But it was not until the 19th century that restaurants and others began selling fried potatoes throughout the country as a separate meal. Recently, a Belgian group launched a campaign aimed at getting the United Nations to recognize the popular treat. The group wants the UN's educational, scientific, and cultural organization to place the food on its cultural heritage list. The UNESCO list recognizes more than 300 objects, beliefs, and practices. They include Turkish coffee and the traditional Chinese theater known as Peking Opera. The list also includes a dance, the Argentinian tango, and the singing of the Aka Pygmies of the Central African Republic. UNESCO says the list is made up of intangible heritage elements that help demonstrate the diversity of heritage and raise awareness about its importance. To appear on the list, each item needs an expression of support from a minister of culture. Belgium has three such ministers, one for each part of the country. Last year, the government of the Dutch-speaking area of Flanders recognized Belgian fried potatoes as an important part of national culture. The French and German-speaking communities are expected to debate the issue this year. Belgian potato fries are traditionally sold in a paper wrapper or cone in a fritkot, a small building or shack. There are about 5,000 fritkots in Belgium. That means they are 10 times more common as a percentage of the population as McDonald's restaurants in the United States. The National Organization of Fritkot Owners says the small, often unfinished buildings are much like Belgium itself. It says these buildings combine the country's acceptance of disorder with a dislike of structures that all look the same. The group says 95% of Belgians visit a fried potato shack at least once a year. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Thanks, Christopher. I'm Ana Mateo.
And I'm Mario Ritter. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is program on The Voice of America.
Words and Their Stories is next, followed by People in America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Thank you. the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. The word homeland is getting new attention in the United States. Soon after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, the U.S. Congress approved a new executive-level department called the Department of Homeland Security. This department took responsibility for parts of the country's borders, transportation system, ports, and other important structures. The word homeland first appeared in modern English in the 1660s. It combined the nouns home and land. But a deeper look at how the word homeland was used outside of the U.S. shows why some people are not comfortable with it. The government of South Africa used the word homeland for areas it created for only African peoples during the period of apartheid. These homelands separated the Africans from white citizens. Frederica Eigler is a professor of German at Georgetown University. She said that in Germany, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, people used a similar word to homeland, Heimat, to express intense national pride.
It became more and more a political term because it was sort of meshed up with ideas of the nation and nationalism. And then that kind of came to a head during World War II, which became very, very much tied up with notions of the German race and the nation, nationality, or national socialism. And so in that sense, it got very discredited as a result in the post-war period.
In the early 2000s, when the U.S. government created the Department of Homeland Security, some objected to the name. Peggy Noonan writes for the Wall Street Journal. She thought the Bush administration should change the name. She said homeland isn't really an American word. James A. Bartlett blogs for The Ethical Spectacle. He thinks the problem is that the word homeland has to do with the idea of being a native. He quotes the second Merriam-Webster definition of homeland, a state or area set aside to be a state for a people of a particular national, cultural, or racial origin. Mr. Bartlett believes the word homeland does not describe the United States well. The U.S. is a diverse country of immigrants. Are those immigrants also able to call the U.S. their homeland? Yet an increasing number of Americans seem to like the word. Some people are proposing it as the name for the group of people born between 2005 and 2030. For instance, many voters in a 2005 Webb poll wanted to call the group the Homeland Generation. The White House used the term in an October 2014 report. Professor Eigler at Georgetown University observed that today's generation is growing up with the war on terror.
My sense is the larger context, again, is, you know, with that term, is the importance of issues of national security in the context of the global war on terror, and you know that larger context that is very much part of our contemporary life and has been for quite some time. And of course they grew up with that. It wasn't something new, but it was part of, or is part of, their lives from the very beginning.
And that's Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Brown.
I'm Faith Lapidus.
And I'm Steve Ember with People in America in VOA Special English. Today we tell about Betty Friedan. She was a powerful activist for the rights of women.
Betty Friedan is often called the mother of the modern women's liberation movement. Her famous book, The Feminine Mystique, changed America. Some people say it changed the world. It has been called one of the most influential nonfiction books of the 20th century. Friedan reawakened the feminist movement in the United States. That movement had helped women gain the right to vote in the 1920s. Modern feminists disagree about how to describe themselves and their movement, but activists say men and women should have equal chances for economic, social, and intellectual satisfaction in life.
50 years ago, life for women in the United States was very different from today. Very few parents urged their daughters to become lawyers or doctors or professors. Female workers doing the same jobs as men earned much less money. Women often lost their jobs when they had a baby. There were few child care centers for working parents. Betty Friedan once spoke to ABC Television about her support for sharing responsibility for the care of children.
If child rearing was considered equally the responsibility of women and men, or women and men in society, then we really could pull up our skirts and declare victory and move on.
Betty Friedan was born Betty Goldstein in 1921 in Peoria, Illinois. Her immigrant father worked as a jeweler. Her mother left her job with a local newspaper to stay home with her family. Betty attended Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. It was one of the country's best colleges for women. She finished her studies in psychology in 1942. After college, she attended the University of California at Berkeley to continue her studies. Her boyfriend at the time did not want her to get an advanced degree in psychology. He apparently felt threatened by her success. So Betty left California and her boyfriend. She moved to New York City and worked as a reporter and editor for labor union newspapers. In 1947, Betty Goldstein married Carl Friedan, a theater director who later became an advertising executive. They had a child, the first of three. The Friedans were to remain married until 1969.
When Betty Friedan became pregnant for the second time, she was dismissed from her job at the newspaper. After that, she worked as an independent reporter for magazines. But her editors often rejected her attempts to write about subjects outside the traditional interests of women. In 1957, Friedan started research that was to have far-reaching results. Her class at Smith College was to gather for the 15th anniversary of their graduation. Friedan prepared an opinion study for the women.
She sent questions to the women about their lives. Most who took part in the study did not work outside their homes. Fredan was not completely satisfied with her life. She thought that her former college classmates might also be dissatisfied. She was right. Fredan thought these intelligent women could give a lot to society if they had another identity besides being homemakers.
Fredan completed more studies. She talked to other women across the country. She met with experts about the questions and answers. She combined this research with observations and examples from her own life. The result was her book, The Feminine Mystique, published in 1963. The book attacked the popular idea of the time that women could only find satisfaction through being married, having children, and taking care of their home. Fredan believed that women wanted more from life than just to please their husbands and children. The book said women suffered from feelings of lack of worth. Fredan said this was because the women depended on their husbands for economic, emotional, and intellectual support.
The Feminine Mystique was a huge success. It has sold more than 3 million copies. It was reprinted in a number of other languages. The book helped change the lives of women in America. More women began working outside the home. More women also began studying traditionally male subjects like law, medicine, and engineering. Betty Friedan expressed the dissatisfaction of some American women during the middle of the 20th century. But she also made many men feel threatened. Later, critics said her book only dealt with the problems of white, educated, wealthy, married women. It did not study the problems of poor white women, single women, or minorities.
In 1966, Betty Friedan helped establish NOW, the National Organization for Women. She served as its first president. She led campaigns to end unfair treatment of women seeking jobs.
We are now strong enough ourselves to see men not as breadwinners, not as instruments, not as sex objects, not as enemies, not as stereotypes, but human beings, our brothers.
Fredan also worked on other issues. She wanted women to have the choice to end their pregnancies. She wanted to create child care centers for working parents. She wanted women to take part in social and political change. Betty Friedan once spoke about her great hopes for women in the 1970s.
Liberating ourselves, we will then become a major political force, perhaps the biggest political force for basic social and political change in America in the 70s.
Betty Friedan led a huge demonstration in New York City for women's rights. Demonstrations were also held in other cities. 500,000 women took part in the Women's Strike for Equality on August 26, 1970. The day marked the 50th anniversary of American women gaining the right to vote. A year after the march, Friedan helped establish the National Women's Political Caucus. She said the group got started to make policy, not coffee. She said America needed more women in public office if women were to gain equal treatment.
Friedan wanted a national guarantee of that equal treatment. She worked tirelessly to get Congress and the states to approve an amendment to the United States Constitution that would provide equal rights for women. The House of Representatives approved this Equal Rights Amendment in 1971. The Senate approved it the following year. 38 of the 50 state legislatures were required to approve the amendment. Congress set a time limit of 7 years for the states to approve it. This was extended to June 30, 1982. However, only 35 states approved the amendment by the deadline, so it never went into effect. The defeat of the ERA was a sad event for Betty Friedan, now, and other activists.
In 1981, Betty Friedan wrote about the condition of the women's movement. Her book was called The Second Stage. Friedan wrote that the time for huge demonstrations and other such events had passed. She urged the movement to try to increase its influence on American political life. Some younger members of the movement denounced her as too conservative. As she grew older, Friedan studied conditions for older Americans. She wrote a book called The Fountain of Age in 1993. She wrote that society often dismisses old people as no longer important or useful. Friedan's last book was published in 2000. She was almost 80 years old at the time. Its title was Life So Far. Betty Friedan died on February 4, 2006. It was her 85th birthday. Betty Friedan once told a television reporter how she wanted to be remembered.
She helped make it better for women to feel about being women. And therefore, she helped make it possible for women to more freely love men.
This program was written by Geraldine Watson. It was produced by Lawan Davis. I'm Faith Lapidus.
And I'm Steve Ember. You can download a transcript and audio of this show at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for People in America in VOA Special English.